When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about on Wednesday. Boeing was the subject of back-to-back Senate hearings, one by the Senate Commerce Committee. They heard from members of an expert panel that found serious flaws in Boeing's safety culture. Also, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. They examined Boeing's broken safety culture and got firsthand accounts from people who testified. One guy getting a lot of attention, his name, Ed Pearson. Ed, a former Boeing manager, now the executive director of the Foundation for Aviation Safety. You may remember him. He was the guy who was going to be flying, evidently had booked himself on flights that weren't planes that he was familiar with, no 737 MAX for him. And he walked off the flight saying, look, I don't think they're safe. And obviously the flight attendants didn't want him to get off. He didn't want to make a scene, but it became a story and he retired shortly thereafter. And look, his retirement, 2 months before the first 737 MAX crash. So now testifying in front of the Senate committee, and the quote that's getting a lot of attention, he says, look, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. This is a criminal cover-up. He said, records do in fact exist. I know this because I personally passed them on to the FBI. He went on to say that the manufacturing conditions that led to the two 737 MAX disasters also led to the Alaskan blowout accident, and these conditions continue. He says Boeing illegally stopped conducting thousands of quality control inspections, and hundreds of airplanes left Boeing's factories without these inspections. Now, we've heard this before. We've heard it in a bunch of places. And should we be surprised? This is the argument that they've been making for a long time. Corporate America has been saying, no, let us regulate ourselves. Let us police ourselves. We'll do what's in the best interest for us. Now, understand, we've seen failure after failure after failure of this play out, and yet we're still sold the same garbage because, you know, regulations are bad. Job-killing regulations. Never mind the fact that the people-killing lack of regulations. And understand, you know, it's just two planes that fell out of the sky. And their argument is, well, you know, it's not a big deal. It's only two, I guess. And it got me to thinking about, you know, the idea of corporations policing themselves and how they use, well, disaster capitalism to decide whether they're going to act in the best interest of you or me instead of themselves. because that argument that corporate America is going to act in their best interest, and we like to believe, well, they don't want to get sued. They don't want to, you know, get a bad PR. And the reality is they don't care about any of that. They don't even care about the product. What they care about is profit. And if killing a couple of people, injuring, maiming, whatever, if that means higher profits, well, that's just the cost of doing business. In this new kind of deregulated environment where corporate America polices themselves. And what I found interesting, and look, this is not new. We've talked about this before. In fact, we're talking about it back when the two planes crashed. Not surprising, not even a little bit. One, this is what happens when you have a near monopoly corporation where there's no competition. And two, this is where you have a swinging door between the people who are supposed to be onlooking and the people who are, well, not onlooking. But I kept coming back to this moment where what we were sold, and you may remember over the last several months, what have we heard about Boeing's problems? Let's steal it from Elon Musk. I won't even go to Fox News or any of those. Elon. Elon was he was complaining about diversity, equity, and inclusion. He was worried about corporate governance. In fact, he tweeted out, do you want to fly in an airplane where they prioritized DEI hiring over your safety? That's actually happening, he wrote. And I'm going, no, I don't know about that. What we know is they've been trying to kill the golden goose for a very long time. Boeing had a high quality workforce in Washington State. They had people who, and we had folks on from SPIA, the engineers who designed the planes. We've talked to workers there over the years. And it's the culture that management has created that's put this company in peril. And you can go back to 2008 when the Machinist Union accused Boeing of unfair labor practices and union busting tactics while they were negotiating a contract. 2014, the Machinists accused Boeing of threatening to move production out of the state. Do what we say or we're moving. And really attempting to weaken the voice of workers who could raise these concerns. In 2018, Boeing workers in South Carolina, they voted against unionizing because, well, guess what? Boeing put down the hammer, put down the heavy hand. And again, allegations of massive harassment and intimidation and anti-union busting tactics by Boeing. 2019, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, they issued a complaint against Boeing, alleging that they had, in fact, retaliated against workers trying to organize in South Carolina. 2020, SPIA, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, they accused Boeing of engaging in union-busting tactics during their contract negotiation. Again, weakening the voices on the front line. This is about tearing apart a culture that was all about ensuring that workers had had a voice, we're empowered to fix things. No. What we're going to do instead is we're just going to pencil whip things through because it's about the profit. It's not about the people. It's about the profit. This is the story that's being weaved. This is the story that I keep coming across. And look, it's not new. You know, Ed Pearson says, it's criminal. And I agree, but sadly, nobody's going to jail. Because we don't do this to corporate America. We don't lock up our white-collar criminals. They were just trying to enrich the shareholders. But we know this is what they do. We know that how this works. And sadly, we just kind of let it go. And this has been, in my view, the result of decades of union busting. Decades of taking worker power and workers' voices away. You know, this Ed Pearson, they're calling him a whistleblower. And he was saying that there were problems all along. And you go, I'm sorry. you were a guy who was in charge of this. Maybe if you had some power to maybe stop some of it, maybe two planes wouldn't have fallen out of the sky. I don't know. This is what happens when you have, well, dictatorships, when you have the kind of power that Boeing exerts over its workforce. And how'd that happen? Well, I mean, we can go back decades and think about, you know, you go back to the ultimate union buster, Ronald Reagan, who I blame a lot of the current economic problems on. You go back to when Reagan fired the Patco workers in 81. Not only did he fire them, he banned them from all future employment. And that was that one thing, was the shot heard across the boardroom. Corporate America knew it was open season on workers. And you throw in Reagan's anti-union appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, the Department of Labor, all of those places that were there to ensure workers had some power, had a voice. But again, this is a guy who was a former union president himself, opposing collective bargaining for federal workers. This is a guy who was a union leader himself, supporting the whole no rights at work agenda. He supported right to work, which we know weakened unions' ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. And, you know, what he did through his budgets, again, harmful. Attacking OSHA, gutting their funding, gutting the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA's budgets, gutting all of those things that keep people safe. I mean, he did all of the things you would expect from a Republican now, but back then it was a big deal. Weakening workplace protections, pushing for massive deregulation, which, hello, look where we are. And it was Reagan who brought us that tax policy of, hey, let's give all this wealth to the wealthy. Let's give them all the money because they're smart. They know what to do with it. One of the worst presidents for working people in the history of this country. Because of him, we have massive inequality. Not that we didn't have inequality back then, but it has grown to epic proportions. And you go, well, what do? Well, we undo the damage of the Reagan era. We undo the damage that he caused. Give workers the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. Give workers the ability to have a voice. So when problems come up, there's somewhere to go. And maybe we don't have to have hearings years after the fact where someone goes, you know, it's criminal. You know, we knew they were pencil whipping thousands of inspections. We knew the system was incestuous with the swinging door of people going from industry to regulator to back and forth. And it's not just Boeing. So for me, what I would like to see out of this, and I know the CEO's leaving at the end of the year. I know there's he's got a golden parachute coming. He'll be fine. I'd like to see some of these people, I don't know, truly held accountable. Now, I've had people say, well, we need to break up Boeing. I'm not 100% opposed to it. Competition's not a bad thing. But the reality is this is a giant company, global company, was the biggest. They've given it away because of their short-term thinking. And the bigger part of this is not to pick on Boeing. They're like any corporation where you give them the choice between doing what's right and doing what's profitable. They're going to do what's profitable. And that's just how it is across the board. And I've always said that unionized workers, workers who have the power to say no, the power to speak up in moments where it matters, and the protections to do so, are actually beneficial for the companies. Because had you had people at the beginning, you know, I don't know, a year before Mr. Pearson got off the plane, because I don't want him to be looked at as like some hero. But had they done something a year prior and said, hey, wait a second, we missed that inspection. We should go back and do that. well, wait a minute, there's stuff getting out of here that's not quite right. We should fix that. If you don't understand the system, maybe, oh, I don't know, don't use it. But we're in a moment where corporate America gets what corporate America wants. So do I have any true hope or faith that someone's going to be held accountable? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. When do we start holding corporate America accountable? We give them so much and we expect what seems to be so little. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Ah, yes, our benevolent dictators, our corporate CEOs, and the ultra wealthy. And the reason I bring this up is a lot of our benevolent dictators are lacking in benevolence. And I look at Elon Musk, who, you know, is a benevolent dictator minus the benevolence, obviously enough. And what I find weird is there was a story caught my attention. Evidently, Musk put out an internal memo that says that Tesla is going to cut over 10% of its global workforce. Evidently, according to Elon's letter, you know, they've grown too fast, too rapidly, and there's duplication, there's redundancy. And in corporate speak, that's bad. That's bad because it's bad for, well, his pocket. He goes on to say that the cuts are going to help them become lean, innovative, and hungry for the next growth phase. And look, it's all about the bottom line. Understand that. It's all about, hey, how much can we make? How much can we put in our pocket? And how little can I pay you? And, you know, the reality is they're going to, you know, this email was sent out and they're laying people off. It's the first large scale layoff, I guess, for workers at its Buffalo plant. I guess since what, 2023? So you're starting to see this stuff happen. And I guess it was done by email. Congratulations. And my mind went into this place where had they a union, had they a voice on the job, maybe this doesn't happen. And maybe it doesn't happen this way. And I guess, you know, they sent this memo out at midnight. And it's one of those things where you go, what's Elon doing up at these hours? Like, you know. So on Sunday, evidently, workers who were impacted by these received their email through their personal accounts. Again, that's why you never give your employer a personal email, telling them that they're no longer needed. In fact, the email said, effective now, you will not need to perform any further work and therefore will no longer have access to Tesla systems or and physical locations. Now, you know, what does this mean? Well, it means that another example of a very profitable company wanting more and taking it out on the workforce, which is why you are seeing, and I think about time, you are seeing workers finally coming around to the idea that, you know, we do need some voice on the job. And look, for me, this layoff by Musk, this move by Tesla, might actually be a good thing to wake people up to go, look, we're just numbers on a spreadsheet. We're just negatives on their balance sheet, disposable at any time. Look, you know, I said, you know, had there been a UAW union there representing those workers, there still may have been layoffs. It wouldn't have been this way. There would have been a negotiation. There would have been stuff there, or there had been recourse. But again, this is why I think what we're seeing is we're seeing some momentum, especially in the South, where you haven't seen a lot of organizing activity. You've seen a lot of abuses in the workplace. And finally, some folks are going, maybe now's the time. And you look at the fact that the UAW is you know, full-scale organizing the non-union plants down in the South, which I found interesting that you got governors from six of those Southern states, you know, warning workers, you better not join that union. Bad things will happen. And look, intimidation, you know, in places like Tennessee, not new. If you remember when they had the Volkswagen election, you know, a couple of years ago, they had all the politicians, all of the big money people saying, well, you know, if you vote for a little bit of a raise, you know, bad things are going to happen. And is it any surprise that it's Tennessee at the front of it? With Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, Alabama. Are we surprised that it's their governors who are saying, no, you working people, you don't need that. Continue to be at-will employees at the will of your benevolent dictator. Continue to take what you're given instead of what you earn. And I find it interesting that you've got these governors who are more concerned about the corporations than they are about their citizens. But, you know, are we surprised? No, we shouldn't be. Not even a little bit. And, you know, this idea that, you know, they're attacking the UAW, you know, because they have serious reservations that the UAW can represent our values. Did you know they proudly call themselves democratic socialists? And seem more focused on helping President Biden get reelected than on the auto worker jobs being cut at plants they already represent. This is what the governors wrote. And, you know, you look at the push towards using elected officials to do your union busting. It's quite remarkable how much power corporate America has. Because Alabama, I brought up Alabama, immediately you've got the Senate that just passed a bill that would punish companies that had the audacity to engage in a voluntary recognition of unions and their workers' will. Now remember, you know, my Republican friends tell us how much they love small, less intrusive government. Get government out of our lives! And yet, they're saying that government will be right in between the relationship between you and your employer. And what they're saying in this case is that any company that does this, any organization, any company, anyone that looks to the state for any economic development money, if you go against us and you voluntarily recognize the will of your workers, we're going to cut you off. You'll get nothing. And understand, you know, as we speak, you know, the Mercedes workers in Alabama are coming up on a vote to get representation. So it seems what's the word I'm looking for? Convenient? Seems well timed that the vote is coming up over these workers, you know, choosing their destiny, choosing whether they want to be represented and they want to have the benefits that come from that. And then the scare tactics come. And look, this isn't new. Georgia, you know, has already done the same thing. In Georgia, they've actually put it on the governor's desk, Senate Bill 362, which would do, again, the same thing. It would punish employers that have the audacity to recognize the wishes and the will of their workforce. And the thing that gets me is this is perpetuating that it has to be adversarial. That the company has to put up, you know, the kind of union busting campaign and the kind of harassment and intimidation that they've become famous for. Instead of saying, look, you know, we can partner with our workers. We can partner with the UAW to ensure that we get the best quality workforce, that we keep people. But that's not corporate America today. And what's kind of frustrating is we put up with our elected officials doing this. Because look, Alabama, Georgia, they're not the only ones. This is red state stuff. This is model legislation stuff coming from, a very famous legislative group or council, if you will. And what's the end goal? Well, the end goal is what it's always about. More for them, less for you. More for the shareholders, more for the wealthy, more for politicians that side with them, and less for you, less for the people who do the actual work. And you think about what's happened over these last 40 plus years, where we had a prosperous middle class, a prosperous working class. And because of bad policy, because of corporate policy, deference to corporate interests, workers are struggling. I mean, in my lifetime, one income could support a family. And fairly reasonably. I think back to my grandparents. One income, one working class income could support a family. And what's happened? Well, they've gutted wages, stagnant and declining in many industries. In fact, I just had someone today go, "Well, they pay us all this money." I go, "Yeah, it's less than it was 30 years ago. Our standard of living has dropped over the last 30 years. And the question is when will working people say enough and start looking at these politicians for who they are? Part of the best democracy money can buy. And when will we start running for things? When will we start pushing back on these policies? This isn't going to make any working person's life better. This isn't going to put food on the table. This isn't going to help keep a roof over anyone's head. This isn't about helping you or me or, well, any working person. You know who it's about. It's about ensuring the wealthy stay so. Will we put up with it? Probably. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the question I think a lot of folks are wondering, will we see another clown show in the U.S. House of Representatives? Will we see another speaker go the way of Kevin McCarthy? Will we see Republicans showing us who they are? And as I said yesterday on the program, I think what the Republicans are showing us is they want Hakeem Jeffries as speaker. I think what they want is really what they really want is Nancy Pelosi as speaker, because they clearly don't have the ability to govern. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what can we expect out of the unexpected nightmare that the Republicans have shown us in the House of Esther Goodfriend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So we're going to see another clown show, or do you think the Democrats will bail them out if it goes that far?
Well, just think about this. When I was in Congress, when I first went there, we had the Gingrich Clinton battle of the decades, right? It was a love fest. Today it's one battle and it's Republicans. You're right about the Republicans wanting Nancy Pelosi back, because Hakeem Jeffries doesn't register on the scale of look what he's going to do to you.
Yep.
Because they haven't done anything on the Democratic side to cause that to happen, because the Republicans have taken full frontal war with each other in the U.S. House. And so now Speaker Johnson was smart. He divided the entire funding process for these, I'll call them foreign bills, into four parts: a separate Israeli bill, a separate Ukrainian bill, a separate Taiwan bill. And then, of course, he's going to do, this is sort of like a, Rick, like a fire sale. You got this bill, that bill. And by the way, we're going to give you a bonus bill on the border. How about that? So he's adding the bonus bill on the border, which will, of course,
if you satisfy. Act now.
Yes, if you act now, you get the bonus bill on top of it. You get instant deportation. How about that as a fire sale? So he's going to do that. Now, this technically saves him with a lot of members, because you have your chance to down the Ukraine bill with your vote. But remember, and you know this is thinking in the old days is where my mind's going, where, well, I had my chance. I voted against the Ukraine. I'm not going to throw the speaker out over it. I lost, but, you know, I'll move on for another battle.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. Marjorie Taylor Three Names, which I put now in my reports. I have to credit you for that one. Marjorie Taylor Three Names is, you know, out for blood. Of course, she's getting hit so hard by most of her colleagues on the Republican side, but that doesn't necessarily stop her. So we have to understand that Marjorie Taylor Greene, by the way, I consider to be the worst Republican in America, literally the worst.
That's saying something.
People, they'll say to me, well, she's a patriotic, good Republican. No, she's not. She is willing, for personal reasons, personal publicity, personal style of how she wants to work, because she doesn't want to work. She's willing to burn the House down. She's willing to take the Republican Party out of the House. If, in fact, she's successful in vacating that seat on the Speaker, even after all of this, even after he separated the bills, which gives her chance to vote against the Ukraine, if she's successful, it is over with. Ground zero, done for the Republicans. They will not control the House in November. It will be Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. Now, the wild card here is the Democratic side.
Yeah.
Who, again, like I said, right now, there's no national polling where people say, oh, Hakeem Jeffries is going to take away your democracy or your freedom. It's not out there. So he as an individual leader of the Democratic side in the House, and his caucus are in a very enviable position of, you know, being in a better place than the Republican side. But they're going to probably, if Marjorie Taylor Greene has her way, they're probably going to have to make a decision. Do they bail out the Speaker, or do they let, you know, the Congress go into chaos? They're going to have to make a decision, probably.
Yeah, and look, you know, and the Democrats might have the opportunity to go, look, we want something. We'll save you. At least, you know, this is how my mind works. We'll save your speakership, but we've got some stuff that we need to get done. We've got an agenda that the White House wants. We've got some stuff that we need. You've got to move this.
Well, now here's the other thing, too. If they do bail out the speaker, the Democratic side, they really need to make this an event. They need to build it up. They need to have the press conferences. They need to get 4 to 5 to 6 days of media out of this, of why they're doing this for the good of the country. They don't want the floor to go into chaos when we are in global threats. First of all, they don't want the floor to go into chaos with ongoing situations of education, education funding, the budget, inflation, gasoline, you know, all the domestic issues.
No, the world's on fire. I mean, we can't be, as the world leader, we can't be this dysfunctional in this important moment in history.
Right. And so they've got plenty of domestic and international reasons to be able to you know, I'll just say politically milk this, which they should, because they need to not just say, oh, yeah, OK, by the way, we're going to vote and bail you out. And we know you appreciate it. No, they need to build up as to why, because it shows leadership on their part. It would show them willing to reach across the aisle to actually save a Republican for the good of the country. And then behind the scenes, they need to make it also clear to the, just like you said to the speaker, hey, we have an agenda that helps America, and we want your word on what you're going to do with that agenda, or giving us the chance to, you know, to do amendments or to put forth bills. Sure. So it can be a win. Now, I have friends of mine that are saying, oh, no, they need to just let the Republicans go for 2 months. Well, it's true. The Republicans would probably go for 2 months, but it would be such a chaos and a chaotic point that eventually, look, the whole system will get blamed.
No, look, at the end of this, I'm very much someone who says, you know, if you know, someone's doing harm to themselves, you know, and it's, these are self-inflicted wounds, you go, you know, let them go. You know, that whole thing, give them enough rope and, you know, they'll hang themselves. But this is much bigger than just the party, right, left, red hat, blue hat. We're in a moment, you know, that I don't know, without funding going to Ukraine, we could end up seeing Ukraine go down. Without being involved in what's going on in Taiwan, who knows what happens there. And look, I don't like what's going on in the Middle East, but if that tinder block explodes, hello, World War III. I don't know if you saw the story the other day. Gen Z is now Googling World War III and can I be drafted? Because, you know, the message now is, you know, with Iran attacking Israel, who knows where this goes?
Right. So these are some of the most precarious times we've seen in modern America. And it's all coming at one point in time, right in the middle of a presidential election. The worst thing that McCarthy, the outgoing previous speaker, the worst thing he conceded to, the one thing he should not have conceded to, no matter what, was one member being able to vacate the chair. When he did that, he created a potential system for such chaos. That was the one thing that he should not have yielded.
Well, he wrote his own ouster paper. I mean, everyone knew when he agreed to that, that was going to happen to him. He had to even know. And as I said, look, he wanted to be speaker. He sold his soul to be speaker. And I wanted that for him. I wanted him to get all of the things that he got and some more. But, you know, I go back to this thing with Iran and Israel. This is kind of a big thing. And all the responses that I'm getting is, you know, the world's on fire because of Joe Biden. This is all Joe Biden's fault, Bob. Every red hat that it's reached out to me over the last couple of days, it's all been, you know, if Donald Trump were president, none of this would be happening. China wouldn't be going after Taiwan. Russia wouldn't be in Ukraine. Everything would be perfect in the Middle East. There's this rose-colored view of if Trump were only president, the world would be in harmony and we would all drink Coke.
Well, first of all, let's go to Trump and Iran for 1 second. There was the Iran nuclear deal. And the first year of, and by the way, this was something that was a control factor on Iran. It was the one point of leverage that the allies, the United States and its allies of the West, it was the one point of leverage they had on Iran, number one. Now, number two, it was something that Iran was in compliance with and through the process of complying, so it would reduce the amount of centrifuges, which makes less of a chance of a nuclear Iran. Now, the other problem with it is that Bibi Netanyahu didn't like it, railed against the Iran deal, got mad at Obama over it. You know, they did everything they could against Obama over the Iran nuclear deal. Trump gets in. The first year he keeps it because he has the Secretary of State that goes to him and says, wait a minute, this is a leverage point. But in comes John Bolton, scary man. And of course, John Bolton has never found a war that he doesn't love. So Bolton comes in and he talks Trump with the new Secretary of State, Pompeo, talks Trump into undoing the Iran deal. And he said, they'll be salivating out of your hand, Bolton told Trump. And the next thing you know, after the shouting's done and we've got a new president, even Trump himself in some statements acknowledged that Bolton led him down the wrong path, you know, that it didn't happen. Iran didn't salivate. They didn't do what we wanted. In fact, there was less control than ever before. So that was one of the beginnings of an unleashed Iran, was the fact that the nuclear deal was canceled and you couldn't go back to it. Even Biden, who was part of the nuclear deal with Obama, couldn't go back to it. So that sets stage one. So if we're going to talk about, you know, who's afraid of whom, once the nuke deal was canceled in the second year of the Trump administration, Iran had basically nothing to lose. And in fact, the moderates were thrown out and the extreme clerics who run the horrible government came in. So that's part of it. And then whether Trump was president or Trump isn't president, or Biden was president or not president, Hamas was most likely, I would say 99.9%, going to do the attack anyway. It's been a hot spot. It's been, you know, a problem since Israel has been Israel with the Palestinians and the Israelis. So they were going to do that. So I don't think the threat was out there. This was coming. The point now is whether President Biden, and so far he's made the right statements, I think. I lived in Iran. I followed this issue. I worked with the issue in Congress. In fact, we worked with Biden's office and other offices at one point in time to look at communication over the nuclear issue. So Biden has responded and told Israel, you know, you're on your own. Now, Israel has built some goodwill. Jordan's airspace, Jordan hit some of the missiles incoming. Saudi Arabia, you know, didn't mind that its airspace was used. But if Israel now retaliates, because the first hit was from Israel to the consulate in Iran, in Syria, Iran hits back, everything stopped luckily. Now, if Israel retaliates in a big way, and Iran retaliates back, at that point in time is where Netanyahu may say to Biden, help us, they're retaliating back on us. Biden has made it clear, and I think rightfully so, that we are not part of this retaliatory strike on Iran, because he doesn't want to get us into World War III in the Mideast. Lindsey Graham, he'd like to, Rick, we should actually make a fund, put a fund together so Lindsey can fly one of those jets over there himself, you know? He's begging for a war. He says, you know, bomb Iran. John Bolton's all over TV now. You know, go get Iran. We should have got Iran before, et cetera. So Biden has made the right statement. We're not going to be part of a retaliatory attack. Here's the problem with it, though. If, in fact, Iran then responds back, do we step in? And that's a problem. And I think at that point in time, no matter who's goading Biden to get into a war, the Biden administration, I would say most likely you're going to say, we are not part of this. This is now between you and them. No, that's where I think you'll go.
And that's where I'm hoping the Biden administration goes. And again, my fear is, you know, 2025 rolls around, the potential of a new president. Who knows where Trump takes us and what he gives away. He's Mr. Art of the Deal. What does he end up giving away to pretend to make peace for the short term? Because again, I look at, you know, this, they keep telling me, you know, when Trump was president, there were no wars. And you go, well, yeah, how much did he give away? How much did he acquiesce to Putin and to other dictators just so that they could like us?
Right. And now, you know, the times have changed. Who reacts or how Trump would have reacted, we don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
we don't know. All we know at this moment in time, there are those trying to goad the president into a war. And I think the most significant statement Biden made the other day is, we are not part of this retaliatory attack. Now, if Iran comes back at Israel, he needs to continue to say, we are not part of these retaliatory attacks.
We'll see where this takes us, especially over the weekend when we see what happens in the House on the vote to fund some of this stuff. I got to get your thoughts on the impeachment attempt of Secretary Mayorkas. I'm of the mindset, and I don't know that Schumer and the Democrats are doing the right thing here. I think let them have their impeachment. I think let them show what kind of a clown show that they are. And, you know, every time they bring up, you know, Mayorkas didn't do this, you go, well, what tools have you given him? You know, we had a bill, you shot it down. It seems to me that by stifling this, potentially it could give it more fuel. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, now, part of me says, watching Marjorie Taylor Greene with her red hat on,
yeah,
on the floor of the Senate, that would be pretty good theater. It would put a little clown nose on her, and it would be perfect Barnum and Bailey. No question about that. So it's a tempting thought. I'm going to go with Schumer on this one. Get rid of the thing. Don't waste my time. That's what he did. 51-40-49. Because, by the way, luckily, the idiotic, I can't stand the cloture rule, the idiotic 60-vote rule that they have calling cloture to make something happen doesn't count in an impeachment that comes over a simple vote. But right. Yes, if I was Schumer, this is the problem. I would go through all these scenarios. In fact, I'd probably give Marjorie Taylor Greene her own little microphone area there and let her, hey,
you I'd want mic her up 24/7.
Take five.
I would mic her up like they do on Sunday in the NFL, and every word she utters, I think, because you know, I agree with you. She's one of the worst in the House. But for me, you know, the question I then come back to is, you know, does this bite Democrats in the behind down the road? It's like, you know, every time they do something, Republicans come back and use something against them. You know, is there anything to that?
Well, the problem with this one that I see on the political side, and that's why I think Schumer did the right thing to dismiss it, the Republicans would manage to use this as a field day, you know, on the border, and what Mayorkas didn't do. The impeachment articles on Mayorkas are so weak that, look, a lot of people just had to hold their nose to even vote yes. Is the border a problem? Yes, the border is a problem. It has been a problem. Congress has failed to solve the problem, so we let presidents, you know, respond to the problem. Obama did this, Bush did that, Trump, Biden. The Congress has failed on this. So I think that probably even Mayorkas himself doesn't become the issue. The Republicans would have just used pure border and people voting, yeah, you know, they're coming across the border, and we know that's not happening, but they would have done that. So by killing this quickly, I think that's eliminated. Now, the Republicans can come back and say, well, you know, Mayorkas, him in there is still, you know, making this a problem. I don't think it's going to change anything. I still think there's a border issue. Biden's going to have to make some executive decisions before the election to, you know, calm some of this down. So I think getting rid of the Mayorkas deal was probably in the best interests of the Democratic side.
My mind just keeps coming back going, let them have their clown show. Same thing with impeaching Biden. I think Raskin, talking to Comer, said, yeah, go ahead. Let's call him back now. Let's have a vote right now to impeach Biden. Because, again, they keep doing this stuff because they don't have an agenda. They don't have a policy direction. They don't have a vision for the country other than self-interest and chaos. And this feeds right into that.
And while they also do this to satisfy people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, I mean, look at the speaker himself. He appoints her in the key position for the impeachment. And it's to keep them, you know, satisfied.
Yeah, keep them busy.
Most members on the Republican side, let's face it, most members do not want to take an impeachment vote on Joe Biden. You know that. I know that. Yep. They know that. But this keeps alive. Jim Jordan is keeping alive the base out there, I know, in America, but the base in Congress. He's keeping them alive of, wow, we're going after him. Maybe we have a chance to impeach him.
Yeah, and all they're doing is showing that, for me anyway, they're showing that they have nothing else and that this is all they have to offer. which is chaos and insanity, because there's no there on either front, the Mayorkas or the Biden front. So this is where we are. But Bob, as always, appreciate the thoughts, the info. As always, good stuff.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. I want to hear your thoughts on with me on the impeachment or not. Should we allow, should we want more Republican craziness? I said let them be as crazy as they're going to be. Quick break, right back.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1857. That was the day that Clarence Darrow was born in Kinsman, Ohio. Darrow was perhaps the original U.S. labor lawyer. Known to be a friend to underdogs, Darrow once supposedly said, quote, "Lost causes are the only ones worth fighting for." Clarence learned his concern for his fellow man from his family. His childhood home was a stop on the Underground Railroad. In 1887, Clarence moved to Chicago to pursue his law career. But his first big client was not an underdog. In fact, he ended up working as the general counsel for the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. But then the 1894 strike by Pullman workers led him to quit his job. And instead, he defended Eugene V. Debs, the president of the American Railway Union. Debs had been imprisoned for his support of the striking Pullman workers. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Although Darrow lost, his reputation as a lawyer for labor was sealed. Over the years, he would go on to successfully defend Big Bill Haywood, leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, when he was accused of murder. Darrow's most well-known case, however, was the Scopes trial. Darrow defended a high school teacher, John Scopes, who had the audacity to teach evolution to high school students in Tennessee, something that was quite controversial at the time. The trial became a major news event. 200 reporters from across the nation covered the case. Darrow won, which was seen as a major shift towards the teaching of science in the classroom. Clarence Darrow is still beloved in Chicago, which holds a ceremony each year remembering his work as a champion of the people. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
And I know I should not want to see the chaos that we have in our House of Representatives. I know I shouldn't want to see it, but I think we need to see it. I think we need to see up close and personal just how dysfunctional the folks in charge of our U.S. House of Representatives are. And I look at James Comer, who is by far, in my view, one of the worst chairmen in the House. And that's saying some things when you start looking at some of the other people. He's been pushing this impeachment narrative, well, since day one. I mean, you know, since the day he took over as the chairman, this has been their thing. And Jimmy Raskin, you know, the other day said, look, you know, tell me, what's the crime? What crime do you want to impeach Joe Biden for? You know, you want to keep this nonsense going. Tell us what the crime is. Tell the American people right now what it is. And Comer's response is, well, you'll find out very soon. And I'm going, wait a second. That's not very soon. How soon? Because remember, this has been going on for almost 2 years now. This has been their thing. This has been their thing. They promised us, you know, Joe Biden, we've got the smoking guns. And yet at every turn, their smoking guns don't even turn out to be water pistols. Because there's no there. And Comer, you know, asks Raskin, is it okay for China to bribe Biden's family with $9 million? And Raskin's like, you know, wait a second. That's been discredited. You know, if Biden took a bribe, and this is what I said from the beginning. If you have Biden taking a bribe, then impeach him. Hold the vote. But this constant having these hearings to drag this out with no movement forward, it's the same kind of, it's a show. It's the bread and circus that keeps the base of the Republicans going, see, they're going after Biden. They're going to get Biden. They're not going to. There's nothing there. But it keeps people from asking, you know, what are you doing? It makes it look like they're doing something when in reality, nothing. And look, the wealthy people in this country, our 10, 100 billionaires, the rest of the shareholder wealth class, they like the status quo. Things are going real well for them because we're not moving to raise taxes on the ultra wealthy. We're not going to close the max size truck loopholes that they're leaving in the tax code so rich people don't have to pay taxes. All the while, working people are struggling. We haven't dealt with inflation yet in ways that I think we should be, which is what? Oh, yeah. Going after these companies that saw a great opportunity to gouge and fleece the American consumer. And not because, oh, I'm going to, because they were all in on it. But we're not allowed to talk about that because we got to worry about, well, nonsense. And trust me, this unfortunately is nonsense. So bring the impeachment because I want to see what you've got. I'm somebody who wants to see what you've got. Show me. Show me the smoking gun. Show me the evidence. And if not, move on. There has to be something else you can do that would be a better use of the time that we pay you to be there. We don't pay you there just for the entertainment value. We pay you to actually get something done. That would be a novel concept. But we'll see. Again, it's not going to end because they, as I've been saying, they don't have a policy agenda. They don't have a vision for the country other than chaos and, hey, look at me. So that means the rest of us have got to do the ultimate in impeaching and throw these bums out come election time. That's what the vote is for, the ultimate term limiter. And all these folks who have shown us who they are, who have no idea of how to govern, we should get them jobs in the private sector. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Miss any part of the program, that. Also, video, freespeech.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.